Welcome, everyone. I'm Owen O'Malley, and we're here to talk about how some benchmarks that we did looking at the different file formats, and in particular, how to access your data from Spark. Who am I? I've been working on Hadoop for a very long time. 2006. Almost 13 years. During that time, I've done a wide range of things. So originally, I was the Hadoop architect, then the MapReduce architect, then I was the security architect, then I went over, actually I did Ambari for 6 months, then Hive, and most recently, working on Oracle at the storage level. So I've touched a lot of pieces. Oh, by the way, feel free to ask questions. I do have a lot of slides, but you know, this is for you guys, so let me know if you have questions right away. I've worked on a lot of the different big data file formats. So I worked on sequence file back in Hadoop, RC file, which is in Hive, ORC, T file. Okay, has anyone heard of T files? They're actually still used, and actually they just started getting used recently. We had one of the guys at Hortonworks come and say, okay, so I was looking at T-File, and we're going to use it, and I was looking at the design spec, and you're the only name I recognize. It's like, ah! It's actually used for log aggregation in Yarn now. Although it's not actually a great fit for that, but leaving that aside. I also was in on the Avro requirements discussion back in the day, because we only had sequence file, and so we needed something better back then, and actually, the Avro requirement discussions, we actually included Christoph, one of the founders of Cloudera, who was at Google at that point. And at that point, Google had an open source protobuf. And so I was like, you know, it's really too bad that Google has an open source protobuf. And so Christoph gets on his cell phone and calls, and like the next month, protobuf is getting released. I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. So yeah, actually, Avro's to thank for protobuf being open source. Okay, so what was our goal? Our goal was really to get some benchmarks for Spark SQL. In particular, Spark has a lot of different ways of doing the same thing. It's a very large project that's been moving very quickly. Have a lot of different input formats. So in particular, we're looking at the file format API because that's where Spark SQL is going to. And the point of this wasn't just to get the numbers. It was really to get understanding about why the numbers are the way they are, right? So benchmarks shouldn't just be about numbers. It's about getting understanding. So they're basically science experiments about what's the software doing, what's working, what isn't working, what can we do better. Actually, one of the pieces that comes out of this, of course, is that you start stealing ideas from the different file formats to make each other better. Customers sometimes complain that there are too many choices in the Hadoop big data ecosystem, but it's actually an ecosystem. And so what I've discovered over the years is that if you had one really good project, it would be good, but it wouldn't get any better. With two projects, they compete for mindshare, and so they take ideas from each other, and they both get much better than either one would be without the competition. Another thing is that the file formats are about compression and performance with compressed data. So real data is really important. Part of what happens, unfortunately, is a lot of the benchmarks focus on TPCDS, which is a really great benchmark. I love their queries, but they generate some of the worst data because it's so compressible. Actually, the first time I did TPCDS back when we were developing Oracle, I was like, wow, that one file just basically disappeared. You get just like utterly insane compression on it. It's less than a bit per row or something crazy. And the other thing is the benchmarks need to be open and open sourced. Actually, these are all open sourced at Apache, and so that people can review it and run it in their environment. Okay, benchmarking is hard. And in a lot of ways, it's harder in the higher level languages even than the lower level languages. So with Java, if you told a college student to do some benchmarks, they do something like this, right? They grab the start time, call the first method they wanted to test with a object. They'd get the time in the middle, call it again in the back end, and then call time to get the finish time, and then do this obvious subtraction. What goes wrong with this? Okay, what goes wrong? Yeah. Yes, indeed. So the first second that your JVM is running, it's running a lot slower than the subsequent seconds because the just-in-time compiler sees what code you're running and then it makes that code machine language code so it doesn't need to go through the interpreter anymore. That makes a huge difference. Actually, that's part of why we did LAP because having a server that stays up is so much faster than having to bring up a new JVM, which both has to read all the files and do the JIT. Actually, the second piece on here is that because of the JIT, it'll make assumptions about the types that get passed in. So what could happen here is if the important, it's the same method, right, just with different input parameters. The first time you call it, it'll get specialized for the A type. So it'll run fast because it can assume it's always an A. The first time you pass a B in, then all of a sudden it says, oh, now I need to check. So it'll actually undo the JIT and then put a type check. So you can actually detect that kind of thing. The third thing, actually, is that because the compiler is allowed to delete code that doesn't have any impact, none of that has any obvious output, right? And so now it can just optimize the whole thing. My mom actually was taught computer science, and she had a class where she gave a student a problem, and they did some code. Then they were looking at the machine code that came out, and they're like, it all disappeared. She's like, yeah, you didn't put an output, so that your code just disappeared with the optimizer. Fortunately, there's a library called JMH that's shipped as part of OpenJDK that really does very well. It stands for Java Micro Benchmark Harness, and it does forks as required so that you get different forks of the compiler. It does warm-up iterations. It does multiple iterations and measures the average, and lets you define parameter suites so you can say do this and this and this and combine all of them. And it provides black holes so that it'll disable the optimizer that will keep your code from running. Okay, so I wanted to talk about the file formats. The first one was Avro. Avro, when we defined it, was necessary to get a cross-language file format for Hadoop because if back in the old days, we just had sequence file. And sequence file, you could only write from Java. So if you tried to do it from C, it would just break because it actually had class names encoded into the file. And so you'd need to load those class names, and you couldn't if you were in C. Scheme evolution was the primary goal. It actually was designed for a file format, which ended up being a little strange because that's not where it's used mostly these days, although it works as a file format. The schema gets segregated from the data. So protobuf, the schema gets partially intermixed with the data. With Avro, all the schema gets put at the end. So you can't understand the data without that schema. And it's a row major format. Row major format means that all the data for a row is put together, and then you do the next row. OK, JSON. I assume everyone knows what JSON is. JSON is a serialized format. We see it a lot because a lot of the web logs come in JSON. It's a row major format. Its schema is completely integrated with the data. You basically, looking at a file, you need to read the entire file to figure out what the schema is. It's a row major format, of course, and compression like gzip is put in on top. ORC was a file format that we defined. It was originally part of Hive. to replace RC file, but now it's a top-level project. The schema is segregated into the footer. It's a column major format. Column major means that you can just read the columns that you need and ignore the rest. So all the compression, all the run length encoding is done in a columnar style. Although then the files are divided up into stripes. Stripes are basically chunks of the file that are self-contained so that an independent task can look at them. It's got a rich type model, all the data is stored top down, and it's got integrated compression, indexes, and statistics. Okay, so Parquet. Now, people do ask why there isn't one of these. And the real answer is that they were developed at the same time by different sets of people. And when ORC came out, then the Parquet guys were like, we've got a file format too. It was originally designed based on Google's Dremel paper. The schema is segregated into the footer. It's a column major format with stripes. It's got a simpler type model. So it's got fewer physical types, but then they add logical types on top. And we'll see some of the impact of that. One of the other pieces that instead of keeping the data in the intermediate parts of the tree, they push everything to the leaves, which means that they have a lot more complexity deserializing. So for example, in ORC, if you've got a list of items, it stores the list, how many elements are on the list. In Parquet, that gets flipped around. So the type at the bottom records, I'm a repeat of the list, and then, this is a new list. So you've got more parsing to do to untangle it. Okay, so the data sets. The other thing that we've observed is that different data sets behave very differently. Now, there's an awesome data set from New York City where they basically, every time someone takes a taxi ride, they put a row into this table. And so they have the start place, the source, the destination, how much the fare was. They used to have which taxi it was, but that's not there anymore. There's 18 columns with no null values. It's all doubles, integers, decimals, and strings. Okay, so decimals and doubles are both types with numbers with floating point numbers in them, right? What's the difference? When would you use, which of the data that you have in here would you use decimals for versus which would you use doubles for?
When you have a big exponent.
Yeah, when you have a big exponent. What was the other answer? I'm sorry. Exactly, the exact and approximate. So the GPS coordinates, those are the doubles. The price that someone paid, that's a decimal. Right, so the GPS is approximate, so it's a double. The price is exact, so it's a decimal. I once had a customer use doubles when they should have used decimals for money. And then they were asking me, why does Hive add things up differently when we do different queries? I was like, too many CS professors don't talk about that kind of stuff. Anyway, 2 months of data is 22 million rows. Okay, the sales table is based on a very large customer. It's their real schema from their production Hive deployment for their online store. They let me have the schema with the caveat that we had to change all the field names, but it's the real schema, and then we base the random data generator based on their real data statistics. It's 55 columns with lots of nulls. It's got a little bit of structure, timestamps, strings, longs, booleans, and a struct. And we generally use 25 million rows. Okay, and the last data set, the taxi one is really hardcore, tightly packed data. The sales one is got some nulls in it, but it's not that far from what you'd see in a relational database. The GitHub logs are completely different. This is a huge, huge schema, and it's the logs from every time someone does an action on a public GitHub repo. GitHub makes that all public, and so you can download as many months of data as you want. Half a month is 10.5 million rows. It's 704 columns with lots and lots of nested structure and lots of nulls. You basically see all the types. Now, one of the challenges with that data set is that they don't tell you what the columns are. So I was looking at this, trying to build a schema, and I was like, okay, this is so not going to work. And so we ended up building a tool that will take a pile of JSON documents and deduce the schema, and it'll go through and unify the types based on the types it's seen. So for example, if a string in JSON looks like a timestamp, it'll guess timestamp, but then if it later looks like a different kind of string, then it'll say, oh, it must have just been a string that happened to look like a timestamp. I'd love to put the schema in here, but it's 12K of schema, so you don't want to see it, especially on a slide. And it's available in the Orc tool jar. Okay, so which software versions do we use? So we use Spark 2.3, Avro 1.8, Orc 1.5, Parquet 1.8, and Spark Avro 4.0. And yes, getting those all into a single jar was hell. Not fun, but got it to all work. Mostly it was because of the dependencies that we didn't need, but the jars were pulling anyway, because both Spark and the file formats were pulling in more than they actually needed. Configuration, we set the Spark SQL ORC filter pushdown to be true, and the implementation to native. They're going to change those defaults in the next version of Spark, but for now they've got, you need those. And the Hadoop configuration, you need to turn on the Avro flag to set it so that it'll read data without the file extension. Okay, so we're using the file format in Spark. JSON, ORC, and Parquet are all there in Spark. Databricks provides an Avro one, but it maps the Spark to Avro types differently than Hive does. And so it in particular maps timestamp, which is the Spark SQL type, into long, where Hive was expecting it to be an int 96, and it treats decimals string instead of bytes. So it's fixable, but effectively for this, the benchmark crashed and burned. Oh, Avro was named after an airplane that flew in World War II, which is why I thought the picture of the airplane crashing was somewhat relevant. Okay, so storage costs. Now, part of what you should care about with the file formats is how large these files are. When Facebook went from RC file to ORC, they saved the equivalent of, I think it was 1,000 machines in their data centers. So data size matters, right? Hadoop, you can scale up, but it still costs you machines. It's also one of the very important factors in the read speed. HDFS, in a production cluster, you get about 15 megabytes a second for each reader. ORC and Parquet use run length encoding and dictionaries. And all the formats have compression. Okay, so now you can see part of what the problem was. So we have the different formats, the different data sets, and then we vary compression too. So then we end up with all of the combinations, which JMH makes pretty handy for us. So in this case, you can see that Parquet with zlib actually was the smallest file, ORC with zlib was the next, and all the way over to JSON with none. JSON with none, of course, is going to be the heaviest because it has the column names repeated over and over again. Okay, so don't use JSON. So I had once had someone, after talking to me, say, I don't know who JSON is, but boy, he's a bad guy. And yeah. You really want Snappy or zlib compression. Snappy in general compresses not as well, but is typically faster. Zlib compresses tighter. Avro has a small compression window, which hurts, and Parquet zlib is smaller than than Orc. Okay, now the sale sizes, we see different things happening. In particular, the Orc ones are the small ones. Parquet and Avro kind of go next, and then poor Jason is down at the end, being very large and overweight over there. Orc did a lot better. The string columns have really small cardinality, so that the dictionary encoding helps. Lots of timestamp columns. And there's no doubles. So timestamp, remember how I said Parquet has a very very small model for physical types? Well, they're modeling timestamps as ints 96. Right, so they just treat it as the number of nanoseconds from 1970. Well, Orc knows it's a timestamp, and so it can encode it better. In particular, it uses the number of nanoseconds from 2010. So it's a lot smaller. Actually, in the next version of Orc, we should probably even move the epoch later. 2010 seemed like a good idea, but it definitely makes our size better. Oh, they just become negative. It's actually when we made it. It wasn't 2010. It must be 2015 because we picked a date in the future so that the current date when we did it was negative, and then it rolled over to positive in a couple of years later. So it must have been 2015. So it works, just like you can have 1969 in all the formats. Although then your time zone library matters a lot. And one of the pieces that matters on this one, there aren't any doubles in this table, partially because people don't actually use doubles. And Orc, to get faster performance on doubles, one of our performance engineers made a change so that it doesn't compress as tightly on doubles because it wasn't doing that. It wasn't making it faster. It was just taking extra time. So he detuned the compression on doubles. And so with a lot of doubles, the Orc size isn't as small. Okay, and then the GitHub sizes. Actually, here we have some surprises. Avro does really, really well. And JSON actually does pretty well as long as you gzip. Now, part of what's going on here is two things. The first is that because the columnar compression has to start over again at the beginning of each column, the common strings like HTTPS have to get relearned on every column. And remember, we've got 700 columns in this data set. So each column doesn't compress as well as the row major ones. Now, we're working on some changes that'll fix that. But for at least right now, the column major ones are not as efficient as the row major for in terms of compression size. Although you see the Zlib, Orc, and Parquet come in right next. And then, of course, with no compression, then JSON is always the biggest. Like I said, JSON and Avro did really well when paired with Zlib. There are a lot of shared strings. And we need to investigate adding Z standard with a pre-built dictionary. Actually, there are challenges in there that are going to take some time. Okay, so the first use case we wanted to look at was if you're reading all the columns and rows, right? You're doing a full table scan. All the formats except for JSON are splittable, right? So that you can divide a file up and have different tasks working on different pieces of it. And the taxi schema in our use case supports columnar batch, which is one of Spark's batch formats in memory, because it's all primitive types. So Now when we look at the times, okay, a few things. First, realize that those numbers are exponential, right? So each line doubles how long it took. So Parquet did the best, Orc did the next best, and Jason was really slow with none. And actually the Zlib and the none are pretty similar actually for Orc and Parquet. And actually even for Snappy. So JSON is very slow to read. We knew that. It does a lot of string parsing. Parquet is faster, and part of the reason is because Orc is going through an extra layer. Orc reads into Hive's vectorized row batch, which then the adapter for Spark converts to an Orc struct and then to a columnar batch. And so we need to short circuit this. And actually, the Spark community is working on a patch. Actually, Dong Jun, who's a Spark committer, is doing that work. And so that'll get sped up. But for now, Parquet is faster. Actually, Dong Jun has done a lot of work optimizing Orc access from Spark. Before he started his work, there was a huge, huge disparity across the board. Okay, now let's look at the sales times. Now we can see that Orc is actually going much faster. So actually here I didn't use a logarithmic graph, sorry about that. But you can see that Orc is faster than Parquet pretty noticeably, and then Jason, of course, is the slow guy. So what's going on? Here it's dominated by the format. The compression matters less, and it's mostly because it doesn't have just primitive types. It's using it uses row instead of the columnar batch. So Orc and Parquet basically are playing on a level playing field. Okay, now with GitHub was the really surprising one actually, because here Parquet was actually designed for this use case. And it actually goes really slow. It's like twice as slow as Orc. But look at JSON. JSON, because it's actually compressed really tight, is going really fast. This one completely blew me away. And what this really means is that Orc and Parquet have a shitload of work to do because that means that the bar is way, way too low. Yes? That's true. That's when there's no compression. Oh, that's true. So it's even reading more data. You're right.
So it's probably because there's nothing.
No, it's still doing a lot of parsing. It's really the case that...
704.
Yeah, you have the 704 columns, which, granted, most of them are null, but I know part of what's going on in Parquet is Parquet ends up allocating and deallocating stuff, right? So you see a lot of GC thrash in the Parquet one. In Orc, you see some GC thrash, but less. But actually, let me go to the next slide. The other thing that happened is that their default is, to use a fixed size for the stripe size for both Orc and Parquet, and so they both end up with a lot, with very small stripes in terms of number of rows. And so they both end up doing a lot of stripe processing over and over again. Actually, when I talked to the Twitter guys, Twitter is the one that did Parquet, they were like, oh yeah, we don't use Twitter for that, or we don't use Parquet for that use case. I was like, okay, thanks for telling everyone. okay, column projection. Only Orc and Parquet are columnar, and they only decompress some columns, and the Spark file format passes in the schema that you want. So the file format can just drop the columns that you need. Obviously, JSON and Avro are exactly the same because they end up... okay, so we've got an exponential graph here. So again, this doubles. So the ones that read the smallest, actually I've grouped them here by which use case. So the GitHub ones, pretty much all the use cases read roughly 4%. Oh no, it's not exponential, it's just flat. The sales one, the ORC is reading less than the Parquet, especially the none, it reads a lot. But then look what happens on the taxi data. Parquet basically goes crazy and starts reading a lot more data. I actually haven't dug into exactly why the column projection is being so much sloppier in Parquet. I would guess that it's because Parquet is split up into fixed-size pages, and they're basically having bad partitioning inside those pages. Predicate pushdown. One of the advanced features of both ORC and Parquet is that you can push a predicate down into the reader, and it will skip all the data that doesn't satisfy the query. Now, we only have relatively simple indexes, right? So don't think of these as database indexes. The ones that both ORC and Parquet have are min or max for each section of rows, and they can throw out sections, especially on sorted columns. ORC also has bloom filters. So in this case, we said, okay, if we want a small range of days, then we can filter out. And for the benchmark, we filtered on a sorted column, because if you filter on an unsorted column, you're not going to get very much difference. ORC has the optional bloom filters, and readers filter out sections of the file. They can either filter out the entire file, the stripe, or a row group. But only ORC goes down to the row group. Parquet only filters out at the stripe level. And then the engine needs to apply the row level filter. Okay, so this is a logarithmic scale. The black one is the total number of rows. The blue one is how much Parquet read, and the green one is how much ORC read. So you can see that ORC basically read the 10,000 rows that were a single row group. Sales, the one in the middle, the predicate pushdown worked for Parquet, and so it basically read one stripe worth of data. It read, what's that, roughly 100, no, it's 200,000 rows, 300,000 rows, something like that. And what happened on the taxi and the GitHub data set is that the Spark reader for Parquet doesn't do filtering based on timestamp. And so because the filter was on timestamp, it didn't know what to do with it. It threw it on the floor, didn't even print out a warning. So when I read these, I was like, why is it reading all the data? And then you look at it and you say, oh, because that's what is supposed to happen. So you can see, again, why the being able to push down to the 10,000 rows makes a huge difference, because you just read a little bit of data. Again, if you had this on a non-logarithmic graph, the ORC one would be so small you couldn't see it. So it wasn't very effective. You do need to turn the ORC predicate pushdown on, and yeah, I talked about the rest of that. But one of the problems, actually, across the board is that because predicate pushdown is an optimization, it's never clear when it gets turned off or isn't used. Now, one of the other pieces that ORC and Parquet can do very fast is because they store a lot of the metadata in the file footer, so that, for example, the file schema, the number of records, the min and max and count of each column is all in there, and you can get that stuff very, very quickly. Okay, so conclusions. First, everything changes, right? This is a point in time, right? So absolutely, as time goes forward, these answers will change. You need to evaluate your needs. If you can use column projection and or predicate pushdown, it makes a big difference. If you can sort your data, that's a huge difference, right? I have had some customers who want to partition their table into these little tiny files so that they can get pruning of their partitions. You're actually way better off sorting on that column instead of doing partition pruning, because partitions are only for a single value. And so if you make a lot of little files, then your HDFS just crumbles under the load. And you don't want to do that to your poor system. Where you use sorting, then it's a little slower to write because you have to sort the data. But realistically, that lets you then push down. So especially in cases where you have a lot of values and they're very different sizes. So think, for example, a website with different properties and different countries. Instead of partitioning on both of those, sort on those two instead, because then the predicate pushdown will do really well at filtering out the rows that you don't need. Bloom filters are only in ORC, partially because Parquet doesn't have the 10,000 row level. And Bloom filters, you need to have it big enough that you have roughly 10 bits per a value. And so if you're doing it 10,000 rows, then you can get a reasonable size Bloom filter. If you are trying to do an entire file or even a stripe, Bloom filters are huge. Bloom filters are incredibly useful in the right use case. So Bloom filters work if you're looking for exact values. So for example, I've got a customer that keeps their table sorted by time because that's how they need to access it the vast majority of the time. But every once in a while, someone will come and say, oh, I want to find everything out about these 10 customers, and we need that report fast. So in that case, Bloom filters are awesome because you're looking for a particular list of 10 users. The data is not sorted, and the Bloom filters let you just read the Bloom filter to say, okay, I need this set of 10,000 rows and that set of 10,000 rows, and everything else can be dropped on the floor. Okay, thank you. Yes? I haven't looked at the R file format. I have looked at the HBase, but there it's the you're right, it's a different T file, but yes. You're right, I should actually look at the Cumulo file. Obviously, Hortonworks has got people I can ask about that. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So this is all checked into the ORC project because that's where it was convenient. But you're right, updating it every 6 months would absolutely make sense because these answers change, right? I mean, this is a very vibrant ecosystem, and so everything's changing all the time.
The other question is, some of these data formats aren't available in different software languages. Parquet especially seems to be very limited in the libraries that are available and who can access them. That may have changed.
Okay, both Parquet and ORC have C++ implementations at this point, and so once you have C++, you can get there. The other thing that's making this better is Arrow. Arrow is yet another Apache project that is basically a columnar in-memory format. And so they're kind of acting as a bridge. Actually, Arrow you can kind of think of as a C++ input-output format interface, right? And so because all the file formats have Arrow interfaces at this point, and then if the execution engines build Arrow interfaces, then they can play together. And Arrow is also designed to be cross-language, so that would be the other way to try and get it. In reality, it's not that hard to get into the C++, as long as you're comfortable with C++. Actually, one of the things that we just did is we made a Ubuntu Snap for Orc, so that you can actually just say snap install Orc, and then you have the libraries and everything installed for you. Any other questions? Well, thank you for coming.